You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
It's been claimed that the collapse of Bear Stearns marked the beginning of the global recession. And this past March, William D. Cohn, an investigative reporter and former investment banker, was a guest on the show to talk about Bear. His book, House of Cards, A Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street, explains why the 86-year-old firm collapsed in just 10 days. Listeners told us that they enjoyed it, so we're going to play it again for you on this Memorial Day. But I should warn you that some of the economic references may be a bit out of date because, as we have learned, sometimes to our regret, the markets change rapidly. I began by asking William Cohn about his reaction to the rave reviews that the book was already receiving.
I'm pinching myself.
How much did Bear Stearns matter to Wall Street and to the global financial system as a whole?
Well, it was the fifth largest, as they say, fifth largest securities firm, but and that's shorthand for the fifth largest publicly traded securities firm, and it was also, therefore, the smallest of the big five. So the problem was not that it was so huge, certainly not anything like a Merrill Lynch or Morgan Stanley, but that it had created all of these interconnected relationships with not only other Wall Street firms, but with financial institutions all over the globe.
Is that what it was known for? What made it special?
No, it wasn't known for that, and I think the revelation of how interconnected it was one of the reasons that the government had to take the action it took a year ago. No, it was known for, first of all, for being around for 85 years and for never having ever lost money in a quarter ever until the end, which is remarkable considering that it had been around through, the Second World War, the Great Depression, or the first Great Depression. Hopefully there won't be another one. And, the Internet.
This is going to be called the Great Catastrophe, I think.
Is that what people have called it?
Well, this is not a crisis. This is a catastrophe. Yeah.
And that's not wrong, actually. It's kind of sad if you think about it, because it didn't need to happen.
And Bear Stearns is so involved in all of the reasons.
Absolutely.
How did it become invested in mortgage-backed securities?
Well, that became, people talk about how, and even the headline on the Times Review today talks about the metaphor of the tsunami. That seems to be the favorite metaphor. And I think that creates a myth about what really happened. And even the CEOs who have testified in front of Congress talk about the tsunami that they're all a victim of. But in fact, what really happened is that executives at these companies made precise choices about what business lines to get into over a long number of years, probably because they felt that they could be profitable and make a lot of money, and they could get paid a lot of money. But Bear Stearns made a conscious decision to actively get into the mortgage-backed security business and to grow that business.
But you used to be an investment banker. If you had been working for a company like this, do you think you would have gone along? Because a lot of smart people got caught up in this thing.
Oh, yeah. The investment banking is not an industry where you raise your hand and become a whistleblower. You're paid way you used to be paid way too much money to be raising your hand. Those that were troublemakers were quickly eliminated. Now, I think the incentive system on Wall Street is partially to blame for this, and I've written a fair amount about my view about this as someone who benefited from it. I think I know what I'm talking about when it comes to that. And the incentive system was such that people were paid huge amounts of money to create and manufacture and sell these securities.
Yeah, but they must have known that there were dangers involved.
Well, dangers involved is a thing that's easy to perceive in hindsight. I think
this is like flipping houses.
Well, it's
somewhere along the line, or maybe you never know that eventually you're going to hit a ceiling and everything is going to collapse.
I mean, I think New York Fed Chairman Tim Geithner told me that he knew that the bubble was inflating and he knew there was trouble brewing. I think the bankers themselves, look, this isn't the first time, let's face it, that Wall Street has innovated something And Wall Street's very good at innovation, financial innovation. They created this securitization market, mortgage-backed securities. And then what they do is they inflate it and inflate it and inflate it until the bubble explodes. I mean, look what happened with Internet IPOs. Same idea.
Well, if Tim Geithner knew and didn't say anything about it.
Well, I'm not saying he didn't say anything about it. He knew about it. He was watching it carefully. And I think it's fair to point out in the case of Tim Geithner, who's now our Secretary of the Treasury, that when he was head of the New York Fed, he wasn't, you know, technically the supervisor of Wall Street securities firms. That role and responsibility belonged to the SEC and Christopher Cox. Tim Geithner was the regulator of banks who borrowed from the discount window and also was on the board of governors.
And there's very little regulation in this story.
Not enough, that's for sure.
So let's look at the people at Bear Stearns. What was former CEO Jimmy Kane's background? We're talking about a man who pretty much is the epitome of the self-made man, isn't he?
Absolutely. His father was I'd say they were solidly middle-class people from on the north side of Chicago. His father was a patent attorney, and Jimmy Kane freely says that he never made more than $75,000 in his life, which, well, seems like a fair amount of money to me, but that was not enough for Jimmy. I think Jimmy never graduated from college. He dropped out of Purdue one semester short. He told me that, and he may have been sort of half-joking about this, but that he really, his ambition was to become a bookie. And he has an encyclopedic knowledge of odds and odds-making and casinos and games of chance. It's absolutely incredible. And, of course, he was a world-class bridge player, which is, of course, how he got to New York.
And what was his reputation on Wall Street?
Oh, rough and tumble. Sharp elbowed, spoke his mind, had no interest in being part of the club and wasn't. And, of course, that came out very clearly in the long-term capital situation.
And the people who worked for him?
Well, the firm prided itself on hiring people that other firms wouldn't. So Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, you know, J.P. Morgan, Harvard, hired the Harvard and Yale Princeton crowd, and Bear Stearns was more than happy to hire poor and smart people who with a deep desire to be rich, as Ace Greenberg used to call them.
My guest is William D. Cohen. His latest book, House of Cards, A Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street, published by Doubleday. Under Jimmy Kane, Bear Stearns posted its first quarterly loss in 86 years. You said none before then. In November 2007, was that the first indication that there was something wrong?
Actually, the first indication, not only at Bear Stearns, but to all of us, frankly, that something was wrong was, you know, back in the spring of 07, when the value of the mortgage-backed securities that these two hedge fund managers at Bear Stearns had invested in started to fall precipitously in value, resulting in the blow-up of the hedge funds in June and July 2007. That's when the first signals, not only at Bear Stearns, but around the globe, began to be felt.
But Kane ended up resigning as CEO after the loss.
Yes.
He stayed on with the company anyway.
Well, there was a great tradition of that at Bear Stearns. When Ace Greenberg gave up being CEO to Jimmy Kane in 1993, Ace stayed as a member of the executive committee and on the board. Jimmy was willing to retire, as he says, from Bear Stearns, and I think one step ahead of the sheriff. I think there was a coup building that would have gotten him. But he stayed on the board of directors, yes.
And Alan D. Schwartz took over.
Correct.
What was his background?
Alan is a remarkable guy, actually. I went to his alma mater, Duke University, and he was a world-class baseball pitcher and quite sought after by schools all over the country. But he was an M&A banker and made his bones, as they say, advising media companies, advised Disney in its purchase of Cap Cities ABC, 20 years ago.
So he had a good reputation.
Oh, very high, excellent reputation.
Did he know what he was getting himself into?
No idea. I think he was, unfortunately, the way Jimmy constructed the succession of people at Bear Stearns, he had a way of eliminating one after another, seriatim, any of the threats to his power, and that would come from the fixed income side of the business. So his last person he eliminated was Warren Spector in August of 2007 after the hedge funds collapsed, leaving it only Alan Schwartz, his co-president, as the only likely successor. Alan really did his best to learn the fixed income side of the business, but he ran out of time, frankly.
Fixed income is where all the problems occurred?
Yes, that's where what I like to say is the manufacturing plant for the mortgage-backed securities was.
Mm-hmm. That was the most profitable part of the firm when they were rolling in dough.
Absolutely.
When did doubts about Bear Stearns' liquidity first surface?
Well, I think there were questions that first began to be raised after the hedge funds blew up.
But rumors mostly, weren't they?
Yes. This starts as rumor. But rumors tend to have a basis in fact. Where there's smoke, there's fire, the old expression. What really happened is that before the hedge funds failed and were liquidated, Bear Stearns agreed to provide the financing to the hedge funds because other people who had been providing the financing to the hedge funds didn't want to do that anymore. So Bear Stearns ended up, in fact, taking on about $1.5 billion of these mortgage-backed securities that were in the hedge funds that they didn't really want to take on, but they did. And that led to their losses and led to the questions about their viability.
How did they deal with those questions?
Not well. The problem is that the management of the firm, including Alan Schwartz and Jimmy Kane, were really much, I'm afraid, wedded to the status quo. They liked the way things were going. They liked all the money they were making. So they resisted calls repeatedly to merge the firm, to raise new equity capital, to get into diversified lines of business. That was really Jimmy who kept putting the nicks on that.
What role did short selling have in this story? How did it contribute to the firm's demise?
Well, that is really a question for the SEC, which has promised to investigate. And now a year later, we know nothing about that investigation, which is too bad. It would be nice if they would come out and tell us.
Well, was there something political there? Because we've just had a change of regime in Washington, and the SEC had been described as rather toothless in the last few years.
I don't want to characterize it as political because I don't really know, but I would imagine that it could have been, and I hope that under a new regime we'll get to the answers here. Mm. It's very important to figure this out.
What happened is they were very dependent on overnight funding, and
yes,
that suddenly dried up.
Huge. That's the key to this whole situation. They, unfortunately, because of greed, because there was more higher profitability in overnight funding rather than long-term funding, it was a lot cheaper. Their profits were higher. The executive committee got paid a lot more. And when a year ago rumors started circulating about the viability of the firm as a counterparty on trades, one of the firm's clients asked Goldman Sachs to step into his shoes and take over his exposure to Bear Stearns. And Goldman eventually did, but in about a 12-hour period, they first said they had to think about it. And while they were thinking about it, the rumors got out into the market that Goldman Sachs thought there were problems with Bear Stearns. And that just led, that led to CNBC and
also, a run on the bank, in effect.
In effect, a run on the bank, yes.
Did the rank-and-file employees know what was going on?
No, they didn't. In fact,
because concerned clients must have been calling. What were they telling them?
Well, I think, the management of the firm at that point, Alan Schwartz, Sam Molinaro, the CFO, Ace Greenberg, still there. Jimmy Kane had, quote, retired, so not Jimmy Kane. We're telling everybody the rumors were unfounded and everything was fine.
My guest is William D. Cohen. His latest book, House of Cards, A Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street, published by Doubleday. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with an interview I did this past March with investigative reporter William D. Cohen. He was here to discuss his book, House of Cards, A Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street, and we are re-airing it for you now. I mentioned that his book was quite well written, and I asked him if it was a reason that he left Wall Street that he knew he could write so well.
I didn't know that, actually. I left the street involuntarily, and I had a wife.
A previous downturn?
Yes, after 9/11. Eventually, the scythe of Wall Street caught up to me. A man with a wife and children is a hostage to fortune, as they say. And I had to figure out something. And I'd loved writing. I was an investigative reporter in Raleigh, North Carolina, but hadn't written a word in 18 years.
Well, one of the questions that comes to mind, in fact, it's been brought up a lot recently, is why weren't the business journalists seeing what was coming?
I think you have to be fair to business journalists in general. I don't think, you know, Wall Street is always very good at fighting the last war, as they say. So had this been a junk bond crisis or had this been an internet IPO crisis, everyone would have figured it out. This was new territory.
Well, Jon Stewart just recently did a segment in which he revealed just how much cheerleading was going on some of the cable systems, CNBC,
yes.
For example.
Yes, for instance.
And they added fuel to the fire, didn't they?
I think that is a fair criticism, and I document some of that in my book. On the one hand, I think they were reporting the facts as they knew them. But, you know, this 24-hour cycle really gets things stirred up.
It seems to me that the journalists actually were impressed by what you call in your subtitle the hubris and wretched excess of Wall Street.
Yes.
Now suddenly we're shocked, just shocked.
Well, and I don't want to paint everybody with the same brush, but I think that some people who cover Wall Street, journalists who cover Wall Street, aspire to be on Wall Street, and that can blind some of their objectivity about the people they're reporting on. I mean, one of the things that I know is I don't want to be on Wall Street. I did that. I had that. And I can at least – and again, I don't mean to denigrate anybody, but I think it's a little harder for the wool to be pulled over my eyes by some of these guys.
Where were Alan Schwartz, the CEO, and Jimmy Cain, the chairman, when Bear Stearns was imploding? Well, you suggest they were missing in action.
They were MIA. Alan was in Palm Beach at the Breakers Hotel hosting for the 21st time the media conference that he had, sort of his version of Alan and Company's media conference, and they, in fact, referred to him around Bear Stearns as Alan and Company, a play on that. And Jimmy Cain was in Detroit playing bridge, where he played bridge tournaments at least three times a year, and they were very serious affairs.
And was it because they just were oblivious to what was going on, to the dangers, the possibility that the company might collapse?
Yes, that's correct.
They were oblivious. How were they? Was everybody oblivious?
Well, I don't think the people in the treasurer's office and the CFO's office who understood how Wall Street financed itself in this overnight lending market were oblivious. I mean, I don't think anybody could have ever conceived of what has happening, but at least those people who I write about in the book were aware of the risks, and of course they weren't being listened to.
Did they assume that the Federal Reserve Bank of New York would save them?
Did they assume that? I don't think anybody could have ever conceived of what the Fed did that weekend happening. You know, it happened, you know, before from time to time, but not on this scale.
Well, the reason I ask is we keep on hearing that some places are too big to fail, to let fail. And I suspect that Bear Stearns, they would have said, well, somebody's going to save us because we're too big to fail.
Well, having talked to people there about what happened during that time, I don't think anybody said anything because I think events were happening so quickly and they realized that I think they were preparing to file for bankruptcy and therefore be liquidated. I think they got saved in literally the 11th hour at like 5 in the morning because the Fed and the Treasury decided they were too big to fail.
So Timothy Geithner, then yes. President of the New York Federal Reserve, got involved, but also the guys in Washington, Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke,
absolutely,
and then Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson. Were they
correct.
All on the same page?
I think with the Bear Stearns bailout, they were on the same page, yes. I think they started diverting somewhat in what happened at Lehman Brothers, but when Bear Stearns came up, they were in crisis mode, and I think the answer is they agreed on what needed to happen.
How much of a role did what happened at Bear Stearns play in the kind of catastrophe we're seeing with the global economy? Can one firm, the fifth largest, have played the kind of role it sounds like it played?
Well, if it were doing isolated activities that no one else was doing, then it wouldn't have played this kind of role. But because of the interconnectedness and the fact that what Bear Stearns was doing was the same thing that Lehman was doing and Merrill was doing and Citi was doing, they're all doing it. And you know, some firms weren't, like Lazard, but most firms were. And they weren't big enough. They didn't take the right steps along the way. And they were literally, by the end, had no choice.
Were they seen as being less culpable than Lehman? I mean, why was it that the government did something to help save them but let Lehman die?
You know how people have theories about age order and birth order? This is purely a function in my mind of the order of events as they happened. Had Lehman been in this precarious position and the run on the bank at Lehman had happened first, Lehman would have been saved, and 6 months later, Bear would have been forced to file bankruptcy, as would happen to Lehman.
What happened in the last days of Bear Stearns when its sale to J.P. Morgan was being negotiated?
I think there was a lot of shock, tears, disbelief, incredulousness. I don't think anybody could possibly have conceived of what happening. And I think when they woke up a year ago and found that they had been sold to J.P. Morgan for $2 a share, they had to bite hard, but I think a lot of them, realistically, were glad that they even got that. And of course, then it was changed to $10 a share.
$2 a share was, I learned in a previous interview, actually kind of imposed on the deal to punish them. And it's also apparent that the people who worked for the company were really punished because many of them owned a fair amount of stock in the company.
You know, you could look at it as punishment. On the other hand, I look at it from the other angle. Had J.P. Morgan not come along, Bear Stearns would have been liquidated, $0 for shareholders and close to $0 for creditors. So I think I think if you ask them now, they'd be thrilled that they got this $10 a share.
Although at the time, they didn't seem to be as pleased.
No.
What did Fixed Income Division COO Paul Friedman tell you about what he and his colleagues did the day that Bear Stearns was sold to their across-the-street neighbor, J.P. Morgan Chase, for $2 a share?
Well, he said that after they had gotten plenty drunk, they thought about mooning their counterparts across 48th Street or 47th Street.
Is this a boys will be boys kind of thing?
I think they just tied a good one on and, let their imaginations run wild a little bit.
So they didn't really do the mooning?
Well, that's an interesting question you ask because Paul and I have had a conversation about this, and he now tells me that he only thought about mooning and that there were too many desks and chairs in the way. So it may be part of Wall Street lore at this point about whether they actually mooned or not, but I'm happy to defer to Paul on that.
My guest is William D. Cohen, whose latest book is House of Cards, A Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street, published by Doubleday. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. This book, by the way, here's a quote from the New York Times. It says, "This volume turns complex Wall Street maneuverings into high drama that is gripping and almost immediately comprehensible to the lay reader." She said, "Almost immediately comprehensible." This is really complicated stuff, isn't it? How do you wind up explaining some of the complex financial transactions without going crazy yourself?
Well, you know, I had been an M&A banker and didn't understand all of this, so I had to learn it myself. And then I knew that, you know, how it had been explained to me would not suffice for most people. So I sort of tore it apart and restored it to its bare minimum and talk about overnight lending and mortgage-backed securities. But basically, I think this is all conveyed most effectively by telling the human drama of what occurred here.
Well, it took over 80 years to build Bear Stearns into a financial giant and then just 10 days for it to disappear. How much was that collapse caused by a lack of confidence and how much by a lack of capital?
They put themselves at risk by having this huge inventory of mortgage-backed securities that were losing value rapidly, and they had used those securities to finance themselves in the overnight market. Had they not done that, then I think they still would be around. But it was a huge lack of confidence that, frankly, has not been restored on Wall Street yet.
Well, we're talking about something that's fueled by subprime mortgages, which is endemic to the whole industry.
You know, remember once upon a time you'd get a mortgage for your house and you'd discuss it with your lender and he would look you in the eye? Those days, unfortunately, are long gone because of financial innovation on Wall Street. I think we're going to get back to that, by the way, and I think that's all very healthy and good. But, you know, it became a money printing machine and Wall Street just gorged on it, as they have often done in the past.
Well, to some degree, aren't they responsible for their own situation because they fought so hard against regulation, and regulation would have protected them against what's happened?
I think one of the things that my book points out in spades is that all of this myth-making about how, you know, the tsunami coming and that they weren't responsible for what happened is just so much falderole. And they made decisions, they took the benefit of those decisions in the good times, and now they have to pay the consequences now that the bad times have arrived.
The only people who have come out of this with okay are the lobbyists who they paid to convince Washington not to have more regulation.
And some of the lobbyists work for the Treasury Department now, including one from Goldman Sachs.
You say that Bear Stearns' cancer, I'm quoting, had metastasized and spread around the world. So is Bear Stearns partly responsible for this global financial crisis?
Well, Bear and Lehman and Merrill and Morgan Stanley and J.P. Morgan.
But there's a domino effect here?
Well, what I guess I meant by that statement is that these securities, these mortgage-backed securities that were manufactured on Wall Street, were then sold to financial institutions all around the world. And that, as they lost value, those firms that bought them, you know, their assets lost tremendous value.
Now, I asked you earlier why Bear Stearns and not Lehman Brothers. A caller wants to know, he says they were selling securities and they were extremely speculative and risky based on no tangible value. Why should the government bail them out under any circumstances?
I think that is a very fair question. I'm sort of a believer in creative destructionism as advocated by Austrian economist Joseph Schumpeter. I think we see extreme creative destructionism going on now, but the people in charge in Washington decided at the time that these firms were too interconnected and too central to the global nervous system to be allowed to fail.
Since they were all involved in the same kinds of activities, why did Bear Stearns fail first? Some other investment bank.
Because it was the smallest, number one. It hadn't diversified into other lines of business. It had less capital, and it had more of its financing reliant on the overnight funding market.
Now, I'm sure there are a lot of journalists out there who saw this as something to write about. But you're out with a book before everybody. Were you on this story pretty much from the start? How did you get this book out so quickly?
Well, it was a lot of hard work. Actually, I was in the middle of another book, and my editor at Doubleday, Bill Thomas, called me up and said, "Do you have any ideas about what we might write about, given this? I'm watching the implosion of my 401k. I quickly decided that Bear Stearns would be the narrative force behind the book, and then I took a page from Tom Friedman's book and said, when he came up with the idea for The World is Flat, and decided he had to be the first one out, and that's pretty much what I decided too.
And you were able to get Tim Geithner, Jimmy Kane to speak on the record. That struck me as a real coup. Is that because you used to work in the business?
I can never explain why people make those decisions. Jimmy Kane decided to go on the record. It took a lot of time, a lot of hard work, but he decided to do it.
When you look at today's financial climate, what keeps you up at night?
I think the thing that I really worry about most is the lack of confidence that still pervades the system. And if we don't get it back, we're not going to restore a viable capital market system. And until the CEOs of these Wall Street firms admit to their role in what happened instead of creating myths about what happened, and that's why I've called for a 9/11 style commission to figure this out if they won't come forward. I think that's what I worry about most.
There are people who feel that there's still a lot more to happen, that Citibank and, or Citicorp and Bank of America still may not survive.
Yes, that's true.
Well, Bear Stearns is gone, Merrill Lynch is gone, Lehman Brothers is gone.
And Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs have turned themselves into bank holding companies. Wall Street is forever changed. And I think we're better off as a result. It was really quite out of control.
And I guess now people in Congress will be more open to regulating, or do you think this is going to be another one of those ideological divide sorts of issues?
Well, I think regulation is well on its way, but I think the market has been very efficient in terms of weeding out winners and losers, and I think that'll happen before regulation is implemented.
Was there any illegal activity involved? Will anybody be indicted as a result of this?
Well, there have been two people indicted, Ralph Chiaffi and Matthew Tenine, the hedge fund managers at Bear Stearns. There are three, I'm told, grand jury investigations into what happened at Lehman Brothers, but no indictments yet. So it remains to be seen.
Thank you so much for being with us today. William D. Cohen, his latest book, House of Cards, A Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street, is published by Doubleday.
Thank you, Leonard.